March 22nd, 1990. KP Lectures, Dr. Sarah Little.
May we bow for the invocation, please. O God, Mother and Father of us all, our help in ages past, our hope for years to come, grant, we pray, that by your grace and for your glory, we may during this hour truly seek after you and find you. May our minds be open to think your thoughts after you. May our hearts be open to learn more of your love. May our wills be ready to dedicate ourselves anew to the ministries to which you have called us. In the name and in the spirit of your Son, our Lord and Savior. Amen. Let us join together, standing as we sing hymn number 373, Take My Life and Let It Be Consecrated, Lord, to Thee.
Bob, I will cherish those remarks. I think it makes clear the meaning of what I said yesterday when I talked about my friend Bob Persky as one of the, perhaps the main reason for my being here and how good it was to honor his and Catherine's parents. As a matter of fact, Bob, I think maybe I should request a copy of that so when I become discouraged, as I do, I can sit down and read it and take a little hope. I thank you for that. And let me assure those of you who are here and who have 11 o'clock classes that I won't run over today. Of all people in the world who is adamant about being to class on time and a teacher who gets there half an hour early to be sure she's there and that the room is set up, it is incredible that I should be one who would run over. I apologize for that. I revised what I have to say. I won't run over today. The topic for our consideration today, equipping the young saints, focus on youth, is very important to me. I think you can pick that up from what you heard Professor Persky say. If I hadn't believed in the urgency of the things I said yesterday and today, I would not have made the trip across the continent from California. And when I speak today, I don't know whether I'll be able to convey how important I think it is for us to be concerned about youth in our world. If I can't convey that, let me just say it in words, that it seems to me that this is one of the top priorities that we who are in the church face. There are two assumptions behind what I have to say today. The first one, and I think this is a quotation from H. Richard Niebuhr, some of you who are more accurate than I am, I'm doing this from memory, check me if I'm wrong or if this should be attributed to someone else. A religious tradition stands always in danger of extinction with the passing of every generation. That, I think you will see, will link in with what I am talking about when I say equipping the young saints. Because if we don't equip the young saints, the tradition in which we stand is, in fact, in danger of extinction. Now, I'm one of the persons in the book that you heard quoted that was very, very interested in trying to claim the nowness of youth ministry. Youth are disciples now. And that was true, but in more recent years, I've begun to see that we cannot focus just on youth now, their present needs and potentials, but that, in fact, the future rests on youth. And then the second assumption that I would want to say is that Christian education for youth is perhaps more urgently important than it has ever been before, not only because of the future of the church, but also because of the great need of youth themselves for direction and purpose in their lives. I know of no other time historically in which youth have been greater at risk. So the plan for this morning is to deal with four deal with youth from four perspectives. First, the situation with respect to youth. Then a little bit more about the search research we talked about yesterday, specifically as it relates to youth. Then some other research of a different nature. And then finally, again, a look to the future under prospects. The situation with respect to youth, generally. Now, what I say may be depressing, but I shall not dwell on it long. It's just that it needs to be said in order to point to the urgency of the situation. I want to quote just a little bit from the volumes of statistics that are available, and I know you have seen those too, just to give a sense of what the situation is. Some of this research comes from Search Institute, from the amazing amount of work they have done directly with youth in a variety of settings, in Minnesota, with the Roman Catholics, with parochial schools, all manner, with the young adolescents and their parents study several years ago. But I am drawing on a variety of sources from different types of investigation of the situation with youth. Just listen to a few of these. The U.S. has the highest teenage pregnancy rate of any industrialized Western country. About 1 million American teenagers become pregnant each year. Almost 6 out of 10 of those pregnancies result in live births. It is estimated that 40% of teenage girls today will become pregnant at least once before they're 20. A second statistic, 3/4 of California high school students admit to cheating on tests fairly regularly and say that most of their classmates accept cheating as a general practice. Of America's young adolescents, 5th to 9th grades, 1/2 of the 7th graders and 2/3 of the 9th graders admit that they cheated during the last 12 months. Lying to one's parents has become the norm. 88% of America's 9th graders report lying to parents at least once during the last 12 months, and most of them say that they lie fairly regularly. Almost 3 out of 10 American high school seniors report shoplifting during the last 12 months. 4 out of every 10 high school seniors have reported getting drunk once or more times during the last 2 weeks. Nearly 2/3 of all high school seniors in 1984 have tried at least one illicit drug. And so we go on and on. In summary, Search Institute, looking at some of that same research, as it studied and reported on its particular resource research involving thousands of American junior and senior high school age kids, they say, we verified and defined what most adults sense, that there have been sweeping changes in how kids see themselves and their world. There has been a major value shift just in the last 10 years, a shift away from social responsibility and toward the self, a shift away from a balance of giving and taking that most of us learned as we were growing up. Our young people have a less optimistic view about the future than in previous decades. And at the same time, adults are giving less help and less direction to young people. Let me mention one other general study that has just come out, or at least it came out, I think toward the end of 1989, and I just got acquainted with it. You may have seen it. It's dramatically shocking to me. Entitled Democracy's Next Generation, A Study of Youth and Teachers, the people of the American way became concerned about what they considered the future of democracy. Are our young people going to be able to carry on the tradition of a democracy? They engaged in telephone interviews with 1,006 young people aged 15 to 24 and then carried on in-depth interviews with another 100 youth. And then they carried on a telephone survey of social studies teachers and had group interviews with those with social studies teachers in Providence, Rhode Island, and Kansas City, Missouri. And they came out with the report, it is time to sound the alarm about the growing disconnectedness of America's youth with democracy. And this is the quotation. Since 18-year-olds won the right to vote in 1972, young people's rate of voter participation has slid steadily downward. Listen to this. When asked to name some qualities that make their country special, the young people sat in silence until one young man said, cable TV. Asked how to encourage more young people to vote, one young woman replied, pay them. Asked about possibilities of involving youth in community affairs, one teacher said, my kids are going to learn to look at community involvement and say, well, that's not going to buy me a Gucci shirt. The conclusion, responsibilities for caring, when they ask about what they felt were their responsibilities for carrying on democracy, they said, well, politicians are wimps, a disgrace, not very smart. One young woman summed up the attitude in her family, when the president comes on TV, we turn the TV off. I find that sad. I do have some words of hope. The interest in the light of what we said yesterday about females' attitude toward faith and the fact that they had higher scales of faith maturity are interesting in the light of the fact that this study shows youth as taking a pessimistic attitude about the future of America, and girls are more pessimistic than boys. I'm not quite sure how to interpret that, a higher level of faith maturity, but greater involvement in pessimism about the future of America. Black youth express the highest level of pessimism. Young Hispanics, the only ethnic group where a majority say that America's best years lie ahead. What does this mean? Very simply, that youth are at risk. And even though there are many, many exceptions and individuals to what I've said, to this dismal picture, the church is called to attention and action. Let's look just a little bit more at some of the material with respect to youth in this major study of Protestant denominations that we talked about yesterday. The question inevitably arises, where is church youth in all of this? And does it make any difference that they're in church? Now, first note that there are church youth in all of the research that I've quoted. We simply don't know who's church youth and who isn't. In the search study, there is entirely church youth. And even though some of those youth are inactive, they did take time to fill out about 300 questions. And that, I think, says something about them. They were selected randomly. Just a few more comments in addition to what I said yesterday. First, with respect to sexuality, let me show that we have data to show what young people believe about topics like abortion, sexual intercourse between unmarried people, homosexual relations. Less than 50% think those things are wrong, with the exception of homosexual relations, and 51% of the church youth think that's wrong. However, Southern Baptist youth differ. They think 80% think that homosexual relations are wrong. Generally, they are higher in designating these actions wrong than youth of other denominations. However, lest those of you who are Southern Baptists, and I expect that's a good many of you, lest you feel too good, let me say that Southern Baptist youth are as active sexually as any other denomination, and more than in several of the denominations that I mentioned. They are somewhat lower in the use of alcohol, not much, but they are in the top listing of those who've tried marijuana or cocaine. And although it is more important to them to belong to and be active in the church than for any other denomination, it is also the case that 7% of your youth have contemplated suicide recently. 22 of them percent admit that they have felt that no one loved them. 11% felt that they needed help but had no one to turn to. These are all Southern Baptist youth, all very much in line with the youth of other denominations. They, like other youth, have cheated in school, 67%. They've hit or beat up someone in school, 42%. they've stolen something from a store, 14%, or they've gotten into trouble in school recently, 60%. Again, much like other youth, and these are church youth, your Southern Baptist youth do turn to the church and value the church more than most other denominations. And they do have, and this is very important, a higher ranking of best friends who are religious and go to church than most other youth. That is a sustaining power. But all in all, the conclusion to be drawn, I think, is that our youth need secure affection and support. As one person, Rick Osmer, who was in the seminar with Bob and me, my successor at Union in Richmond, as Rick Osmer has said, youth need dependable boundaries or conventions within which they can experiment with new behavior, what we sometimes call becoming independent. Sometimes I think we are fearful of suggesting that youth need boundaries, that they need security, so that they have a realm within which they can experiment with new behavior as they become independent. Let me mention, again from the search report on church education, a few of the things that young people say as they tell their faith stories or reflect on their faith journeys, what they say has been important to them. And I hope you can see the importance of this. They say if they could talk to their mother about faith when they were very young, 5 to 12, or even on up through 15, that meant that they became aware of their faith and of growth in faith. It's interesting that 13 to 15-year-olds begin to mention their father is also important, and that it is more important for boys to be able to talk to their father about faith than it is for girls. Perhaps that isn't so strange. They remember family devotions from the time they were very, very young. And they remember times when their families did things together to help people. They mentioned those particular things. They remember and see this as contributing to their growth in faith when they've been able to have conversations with their best friends about faith, and when they are aware of faith in their best friends. And you can see, I think, why I say it's so important that so many of your Southern Baptist youth do designate their best friends as people whom they know in church connections. Many of the other things are very much like what we talked about yesterday. If they participate in the church, even the number of hours they spend doing church-related things makes a difference in their memory of what helped them to grow. It's interesting that for young people, and maybe it isn't strange, more than with adults, they have memories of retreats and church camps as contributing to their growth in faith. When they know that there are people in the church who know their names and care about them, they say, this helped me to grow in faith. And when they worked at the church with adults in doing things to help other people, they say, this helped me to become aware of my growth in faith. Some of them participate in and reflect positively on their relationship to parachurch groups or non-church groups, not a high percentage. When they talk about the programs of Christian education at church and what made a difference to them in their growth in faith, they put at the top of the list teachers, if teachers care about them. And this is very interesting. It makes a difference if teachers are skilled in discipline. The boys say that. Evidently, they like to act up, but they don't. They act up, but they don't like to be allowed to act up. That's my interpretation. That might not be clear. I see some of your smiles, and you may know what I'm talking about if you work with youth. They like teachers who know something about the faith and something about teaching. When you go on and look at the educational strategies in contrast with adults who put the Bible at the top, for example, and these are not in order, but youth more frequently mention things like sexuality education, chemical education. They list even in educational strategies the privilege that they feel they have when they have the opportunity of offering service to others in the church and in the city. And let me just say, as I connect this with our statistical studies that we mentioned earlier, that when we talk about youth saying, and a teacher saying about youth, what would you think they would say about involvement in service to others? And they said that they wouldn't be interested because they wouldn't earn enough to buy a Gucci shirt. These young people, and even some of the other research in the democracy study that I mentioned, do say that they would like to engage in service opportunities, and when they are asked, but you're so busy, they say, but we could find time. I think that's significant. They are interested in help in moral decision making. Just to mention again, the pastor is very important, whether or not he or she works directly with them. If they know that the pastor has a high commitment to Christian education and to youth, they say, and they even, for some reason this comes in, if the pastor takes his or her days in continuing education, that seems to make a difference in terms of the view of effectiveness. The adolescents like to explore different models of youth ministry, and they like to know that they are in a situation where they are taken seriously in terms of program, money, resources, and that kind of thing. All of those, then, I think, are suggested to us and, for me, offer some signs of hope. Let me go on, and at this point, we begin, I think, to move toward even more ideas about signs of hope. I want to talk about some of the things that we found out in this Lilly Endowment Project, Youth Ministry in Theological Schools. The Lilly Endowment was concerned that a major effort be given to youth ministry, developing new models of youth ministry, encouraging research with respect to youth, perhaps most of all, finding ways in which seminaries could help equip pastors and educators for leadership in youth ministry. And all of those things then came together in this project of 4.5 to 5 years in which Union Seminary, under my direction, received funding for these various types of activities. They simply paid the seminary for my time. And out of all of the things that we did and numerous books, which I'm sure you have access to, I simply want to pick out a few of the ideas that came out that we discussed in one setting or another. One of them is the whole question of what I'd call models of spiritual formation of youth. One of our early topics in our seminar was about the question of adolescent spirituality. We're all aware of that kind of yearning, not always with words to express that yearning, but that kind of yearning that youth have to be engaged in something that's important, to feel related to transcendent reality. And we talked about, we invited Charles Shelton, who wrote Adolescent Spirituality, to talk with us. And then we had one person to present a paper on models of spiritual formation. And she talked about several different models. One of them, for those of you who are theologians and historians, you may recognize Ignatian spirituality, the Ignatian disciplines. And we talked about youth who had experimented with forming groups and engaging in the models of discipline called Ignatian spirituality. Then we had another model called Wesleyan branch groups, and some of you may have been exposed to that relatively new material from the Methodists. It's an effort to take the old Wesley class meeting and adapt it for youth, and youth covenant together to engage in prayer, in Bible study, in disciplines during the week, and in confession and setting goals together, which they check on a week later. That has been very effective, as it has been tried out in a number of places in Washington. And then one of the things that we heard about Black spirituality as a model for spirituality for youth groups. We have reports on several groups where there have been ethnographic studies done of Black congregations, and one of our members became almost inspired as he talked about the wonderful way in which music, and you Southern Baptists know that too. I wish we Presbyterians knew it better. Methodists knew more about it. The disciples knew more about it. But in the visits to these churches, there was a high level of influence given to the music, both in the congregation and in youth choirs, youth choir trips, youth presentations via music to agencies in the community. And the main thing, however, was how often in these ethnographic studies of congregations, Black youth participated in worship. They were actually leaders with the pastor in worship. That, to some of us, was both fearful, impossible to think of bringing off, but hopeful in terms of a visible demonstration of youth in the life of the church. One of the things that we talked about was the development of symbolic acts of including youth in the congregation now. One of the most interesting things that turned up in one of our seminars was what was called the temple event. And this was a situation in which at the age of 12, the young people in this particular congregation in which experiment took place, it was a Church of the Brethren congregation. When young people were 12, at the beginning of the year, they were allowed to choose an adult mentor friend. And it was their task during the year to talk regularly with that person, to go with him or her to work, to talk about issues they faced as Christians. But at the beginning of the year, they had a kind of interview about the faith journey of that person. During the year, they talked about theological questions. Donald Miller, who told us about this in Chicago, said that he was invited to be the mentor to a 12-year-old boy right across the street from him. He said, "That really made a difference to me. I didn't know that boy even knew my name." But during the year, they talked regularly. At the end of the year, they had a worship service. And in that worship service, the five youth came up to the front. It was a whole worship service. And interviewed their mentor. They could ask the mentor one question about faith and belief, which that person had to answer to the whole group. The scripture for the day was the event of Jesus going to the temple at 12, as you remember, and interviewing the rabbi and so forth. We asked Don Miller, the person in question, what his young person asked him. And he said, the young person said, "I want to know how you can keep believing in God when the world is in such a mess and things are so desperate with respect to war and peace." And we said, "Don, what did you say?" He didn't tell us, but he had no more than 5 minutes to answer that question. But that symbolic act became for the whole congregation what they called the temple event. They were trying to work out, as many of us were, what we called symbolic acts in which young people were included in the life of the church. One other, what we call ROPE, the rites of passage youth ministry. One of the things that we tried to do was to have seminaries and classes work experimentally in developing new models of youth ministry in relation to field education or in relation to some plan in the community. And the Disciples of Christ Seminary in Enid, Oklahoma, with Stuart McLean, worked on what they call ROPE, rites of passage youth ministry. They were trying to work out a series of activities in which young people had the opportunity to engage in rites of passage into adulthood. One of those series of activities was directed toward helping them to reestablish relationship with nature. One of them was to help them engage in the entry into the economic world, and they did it in something of the way that I mentioned earlier, with a young person becoming identified with an adult, and moving into the business world through that, a number of rites of passage. And then, at the end of that time, a young person was encouraged to affirm his or her decision to identify with the people of God and the community in faith and work, or to say, I cannot do this. And then finally, and many, I wish I could tell you about many of these things. Bob has all this information if you want to follow through on it. With respect to teaching, some fascinating things took place experimentally in seminaries with respect to teaching. In one place, with reference to homiletics, young people were brought in to be the audience, and students preached to young people who critiqued them. In one situation, a panel of young people in a field education church met with the pastor before each worship service, critiqued the sermon afterwards, helped to plan the next sermon. When they did a survey of the congregation said that the quality of preaching and worship had risen considerably. Think about that. In one case, a theology professor went to teach young people theology in a congregation, and the seminary students sat around the edge and listened. Those kinds of things, if you start working on them, you have just an endless supply of possibilities. Let me go on then and mention some of what I call prospects for the future. The first one I'd like to suggest is that we formulate and claim a compelling vision for youth ministry. There have been times in the past when the compelling vision was to build the church of the future, to build the world of the future. Then perhaps a compelling vision was discipleship now. I think perhaps we are in the midst of a time when we're trying to hold those two together, but we need the words for that compelling vision. I suppose most of us need to work on our own way of saying things. But think about it. What holds youth ministry together? What is compelling for you? As a part of the YMTS project, weekend before last, I came to Washington, D.C., where the Washington Theological Consortium, working especially with Wesley Seminary, had a marvelous conference. In many ways, as I said to several of you around here, it was a kind of climax of bringing together the many things we've worked on for these last few years. It was a conference of about 250 or 275 adults, seminary professors, seminarians, national executive officers, key people, pastors and youth ministers and educators with special interest in youth. And in addition to those 250 or 75 adults, 40 high school youth. And they were invited there to help this group of adults to work on a compelling vision for the future and to work on a direction for seminary preparation and for directions and emphases in the life of the particular congregation. That conference was entitled A Flame for the Future, Evangelization of American Culture. And I wish you could have been there to see the role of young people in that conference. Just for example, and this is where my signs of hope come at, if there are people like those 40 young people who are working on their own future, then we need not be too depressed. But for example, when one of the persons had shared a great many and even more of the statistics, different statistics than the ones that I have mentioned, one of the statistics they mentioned was the fact that youth were increasingly disrespectful of their parents. As the youth panel responded to that, one of the handsome young black men stood up and said, "Look, I don't like it for you to go around saying young people trash their parents." He said, "Mine are pretty good, and I like them." And then a young woman stood up and said, "My parents are wonderful, and I don't want you to be letting people think that everybody is like those statistics. Again and again and again, those young people came out and said, we want to help people. You just go around telling us we ought to do something. Help us to get to doing it. They were, I would say, in addition to incredibly helpful speeches, and we brought in people from various disciplines. Larry Rasmussen, Reinhold Niebuhr Professor of Ethics from New York, from Union Seminary in New York, spoke about moral decisions, for example. But and we had biblical studies, we had church history to look at the situation of youth. And those young people hung in there and helped us to think clearly. They were church young people. They were willing to take 4 days. One of them said, well, I got to the bus station from Tennessee at 2:30 last night. I waited to get the Greyhound bus till 7 o'clock, and I'm tired. But they came, and they stuck with it. A flame for the future, evangelization of American culture. And what was being called for with those young people was, help us to remake our world. A second, function with the assumption that youth are both disciples now and the hope of the future. I simply want to reiterate that. Let's pick up that lost concept about the hope of the future. We must pick that up. A third suggestion, view youth as resources, not problems. Joan Lipsitz, whom some of you may have heard since she was a neighbor of yours for so long in the Center for Study of Early Adolescence over at Chapel Hill, she has now moved to Lilly, that was a Lilly-funded project, used to say all the time, the most urgent need is for us to view youth as resources and not problems. And I think I would want to say that even though we do from time to time look at the drastic situation which I have mentioned, it is still the case that youth are our resources. A fourth suggestion, work with the community and the church to capitalize on youth's desire to serve. Now, it is true, as the statistics show, that there is not as high a level of youth interest in service now as was the case earlier, but it is still there. There is still enough of a resident desire to serve for us to recognize it and build on it. Even the democracy report showed that youth were far more willing to engage in service to others than adults thought was the case. One of the most encouraging things that's come up to me recently, about a month ago, I was in Wisconsin, in Green Bay, Wisconsin, which you've heard of, in the town of Manitowoc. I'm not sure that's a correct pronunciation. In Lincoln High School, they have now gone to the point of requiring 20 hours of service for graduation for all high school graduates. They sent me some material about that program later, and I read it with great interest. They had listed 31 places there around the Lincoln High School where youth could choose to serve for 20 hours. The brochure, which they use for public distribution, includes the comments of some of those young people. My project involved helping at a summer day camp. At first, I didn't want to give up time with friends, so I didn't really want to do it. But when my required time was up, I decided to stay on. They really needed me. I didn't want to leave in the middle of the program. Again and again, they talk about how much that service meant to them and what difference it's going to make to them in the future. A fifth suggestion, work on theological perspectives, on the ability to think. The young people said, as the adults did, that they valued being challenged to think deeply in their educational programs. Youth say that when they can do it anonymously and nobody's going to know it. They want it to be able. One of the things that I think we most need to work on with youth is, for example, the theological concept of freedom. In all the studies I've mentioned, particularly in the study on democracy, When youth talk about what they value, they say they value freedom. But when that's explored, that topic, that concept is explored, it's freedom to do what they want to do. It's freedom to try out new behavior. It is not freedom with any kind of constraints or directive. Larry Rasmussen talked about that again and again and said that the biblical understanding of freedom is freedom to serve the Lord, that slavery to truth and to God brings true freedom. How can we work in our programs on freedom? That's only one example of what we need to do in terms of thinking. And then a sixth suggestion is to work on parent education. Most of the things I've said would suggest that. One of the interesting things that's happened to me in my tours of seminaries, last fall in Columbia Seminary in Atlanta, this spring at Pacific School of Religion, a quite different environment, in Berkeley, California, I've made reference to Dan Aylshire from Southern Baptist Seminary to his book, Faith Care. They've bought out the books twice and had to reorder. And when I talk to them about why, they want to use that book not only with teachers but with parents and congregations. Work on parent education. And then finally, develop collegial groups of adults who accept the call to work with youth. Develop collegial groups of adults who accept the call to work with youth. I know some groups of adults who have worked with youth and have grown close together in their efforts truly to minister and to be of service, truly to equip the young saints. And those people have said that in their theological discussions, in their efforts to understand, and in their efforts to serve, they themselves have grown in faith and in the understanding of the meaning of Christian commitment. So I think these things perhaps point in some directions more in terms of stimulating of ideas than of anything else. But most of all, they call upon us to seek a vision and to commit ourselves to the fulfilling and the embodiment of that tradition and that vision. It speaks to us about our need to trust and to believe in youth. May God bless us all in our efforts to respond to that call. Thank you.
Thank you, Sarah Little, for your very informative and interesting and challenging lectures. We appreciate your coming. The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face to shine upon you and be gracious unto you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. Amen.